Welcome to the Athletic Fantasy Baseball Podcast. Derek Van Riper here with Matt Modica. It is Monday, March 2nd. On this episode, we are discussing players that have been big movers in both directions to this point in draft season. So we'll attempt to figure out if the risers are still viable players to target on draft day, and if there might be enough of a discount on some of the fallers to consider them at their reduced prices. Just a quick heads up, this podcast is available on iTunes, Spotify, pretty much anywhere that you want to listen to podcasts. If you're enjoying it on a platform that allows you to rate and review it, we'd greatly appreciate it if you took a moment to do that. And if you're not already a subscriber to The Athletic, you can get 40% off a subscription at theathletic.com/fantasybaseballpodcast. Matt, how's it going for you on this Monday?
It is going good today. You know, we're just getting ever so close to baseball, and you know, I'm really excited. A little concerned about the coronavirus, I'm not going to lie. But besides that, let's do this, baby.
Yeah, lots of movers over the last month. I'm pretty excited to talk about some of these guys because I think they haven't fully been corrected, especially some of these risers we're going to talk about at the very top of the show. I would say if I had to grade the biggest winners of the offseason as it pertains to players who were traded, David Price would probably be the biggest winner of all. Thinking about it more, going from Boston to Los Angeles, the way the Dodgers managed pitching, just getting him away from an environment in Boston where he was clashing Dennis Eckersley in the media, getting him a fresh start, going from the AL East, Fenway no less, to the NL is just such a great shift for him. And he was pitching really well before injuries caught up to him last year. The ADP back in January, we used the NFBC's ADPs for online championships, so 12-team leagues from January, and compared that to the same types of leagues from February. He was just on the fringe of the top 200, like 201 was the ADP in January, and he's moved up to 169. I think he's going to keep trending up as we approach the drafts at the end of March. Where are you willing to go in a snake draft to get David Price, knowing he's got a much better set of circumstances now that he's with the Dodgers?
Yeah, I'm excited. I think for all the reasons you just stated, I love Chavez Ravine. It's actually one of my favorite parks. I got to live in L.A. for a little over 4 years, and I was there constantly. It was like 15 minutes away from where I lived. But, yeah, I'm excited for him in the fact that, you know, the league change and everything. There is still the risk of injury. He's another year older. But I'm looking at the last, like, week or so, so say the last 17 online championship drafts, he's still going at, like, 162 in the last week, which I think will be corrected when we go live. And just for instance, he's side by side with Matthew Boyd. I'm excited for Matthew Boyd as well. I think, you know, he showed a lot of promise. There's still corrections that have to be made. But I'm going to take Price over him every time. And I'm going to take Price much higher than that ADP.
Yeah, I mean, I think if I had to predict where he goes at the end of the month, he's probably going to top out like a 130 ADP. If you were to look from like March 15th to the end of March when that comes out, and there's going to be rooms where he's going to get pushed a little higher than that. There's going to be the occasional room where he falls to like 145 or 150. But if you're getting him at 169 right now, I think you're still getting a nice discount. The other pitcher moved as a part of that whole shuffle was Kenta Maeda in the trade that the Dodgers made with the Twins. Maeda, I just think, is going to be in this position now where he is less likely to transition into a relief role when September rolls around because the Twins don't have quite the same depth the Dodgers do. I'm curious to know first if you agree with that or if you look at the depth and say, you know, they're going to have Rich Hill and they're going to have Michael Pineda and they've got Lewis Thorpe and he's got all these other guys they could start throwing in if they want to go that route, or if you actually see this as a situation where Maeda's got a shot at reaching the higher end of his range of innings this season.
Well, I think he has the ability to pitch more innings as a starter than he has in the past. That's obvious. If I compared him to David Price, I would go Price every time. And I do like Maeda. I've always liked him. But the one thing I do believe is that, say, Minnesota has the division pretty much wrapped up or has a lead, enough of a sizable lead in September, I think they are going to manage his innings. I'm not saying they're going to put him in the bullpen, but I think they will manage him. Of course, you know, come October, their problem has consistently been pitching. And they're going to need, a Berrios, Maeda, Hill as their top three. I don't think you want to go back in with, Jake Odorizzi in that top three. That's just my personal opinion. So I think he will surpass the innings pitched as a starter with the Dodgers. I do think there is the possibility that it will be curbed somewhat in September if it plays out the way I suspect with the Twins and they have enough of a lead where they can kind of manage it.
Yeah, I guess that's the thing you would have to be probably most concerned about. If Cleveland kind of falls off, if the White Sox don't surge enough to push for the division this year, even if they're good enough to hang around for a wild card, the Twins might have that luxury of resting some of their key starters, and certainly they'd want to make sure Maeda's fresh for the postseason because he's going to be a big part of what helps them get to that point over the course of 2020. But in terms of price, I mean, I look at 172 for him. He's up about 15 picks from where he was in January. I think that's going to roll over another 15 or so. Like, I think he becomes a pick 150 consideration, kind of a delayed SP3 or a solid SP4. But he's one of those guys, Matt, I can't think of many matchups where I would sit Kenta Maeda down. Like, I've started to refer to pitchers who I don't take out as crockpot pitchers, guys that you just set and forget because you don't worry about the matchups other than, you know, the occasional like interleague at Colorado in Maeda's case, or if it's a National League pitcher having to make the trip over there. But he's skills-wise, I think, good enough where I'm not really thinking twice about it, especially with so many good matchups in division. I mean, even Cleveland, I don't fear that lineup to the point where I'm sitting down a good starter against them, like kind of a mediocre streamer. Maybe I don't stream against them necessarily, but I'm definitely comfortable rolling Maeda out there against every single team in that division.
Yeah, the division and the matchups. The White Sox are becoming a formidable offense with the things they've put together. And who knows, maybe they even sign a Puig before, you know, in the next week or two. I agree on that. And, you know, I think it was a good move for Minnesota. If they really want to be serious contenders come October, I still think they're going to need to make that, you know, in-season move where they acquire another starting pitcher. You just can't have enough. They have the offense. So that's where I would look.
We'll stick with pitching just for this part of the show, and pitching risers in particular. Frankie Montas has moved up a little bit from 133 to 116. I'm just wondering if people are realizing how good he was before his suspension last year. If that's just kicked in, like they've been realizing, oh, there are three pitches. And if he had somehow done that for a full season, he'd be going a lot earlier than this. So I'm going to bump him up the board. But there could also be a little bit of a dead zone in that range in ADP where people started just pushing a pitcher up into that area because there really weren't a lot of interesting options there. It was kind of like a little cluster of hitters in the early part of draft season.
Yeah, no, he was very good. And like you say, he's been able to throw the ball. He's been able to have velocity. And the split finger was really much everything. It induced that swing and miss that he desperately needed. And if I'm picking between one of the two, because they're going just a few spots away from each other, his teammate Jesus Luzardo, who I believe on a per-inning basis is going to be really good. I mean, if you have eyes and you watched this kid last year, I get the excitement. But I think Montas, you know, the suspension and all that did curb the innings last year. But I would think if fully healthy, he's going to have to be a horse for this team. So I do like him, but this area of starting pitching is kind of interesting. There's a Carrasco there, if you believe he's fully recovered from these health issues, which is still concerning to me, I got to be honest. And a Zach Gallen there, and even a Lance Lynn. So there's some good options here.
Yeah, when I run the projections over at FanGraphs, just to look at the bat and kind of see how that projection system values Frankie Montas relative to other pitchers in the pool. He comes out as an $11 pitcher in a 12-team league like the one that we're talking about. It puts him about 28th among starting pitchers, puts him right in the range of Brandon Woodruff and Corey Kluber. Andrew Heaney comes up really high in just about every projection system. Lucas Giolito is a little bit lower than you'd expect, probably because of, you know, pre-2019 numbers still being baked in pretty heavily. So I'm looking at that, and compared to Woodruff and Kluber, I think he falls a little bit short. compared to Heaney, I think Montas is better. So I think he's grouped appropriately in a relative sense. But I've found that I'm really not drafting pitchers in that area. I mean, in a 12-team league, that ADP of 116 is like the end of the 10th round. And there's a lot of hitters I'm going after there. And I think in a lot of times, as I build out a roster, I've gone with maybe two starters and hopefully by then, maybe my first closer. So I'm kind of pivoting away and filling in with some bats because I think there are a lot of interesting bats in the 100 to 150 range. And that's going to keep me away from Montas, even though I believe in the skills.
It is a very interesting group here. You got, if you're looking for the power, you got a guy like Miguel Sano, who, you know, who does miss a couple of weeks every year, but still hits like 35 home runs. So if you need that power, that's there. I know people love Oscar Mercado. If you're trying to get that speed, he's in this range as well. But another pitcher, I'm gonna go ahead of Montas for me, and he's going maybe a couple of picks high. Oh, actually, they're pretty much side by side. Montas goes maybe one pick higher. Is Mike Soroka? I know he's the big fade in the fantasy industry this year. I'm gonna disagree with that. So, and I just love the Braves setup as well.
Soroka is one of those guys, the approach and the command and things that you don't see jump off the page. Those are things he does exceptionally well. Like, he doesn't have the big strikeout rate, and we see how that works against Zach Greinke, a guy who continues to exceed expectations year over year. So for a younger guy, especially one who's had some injury issues, it's kind of easy to see how people are skeptical of him. But I think I'm more in your camp on that one, where I look at him and say, you know, at that price, I'm fine with Mike Soroka. I think he's a little bit similar to maybe a Kyle Hendricks type in terms of like what he's likely to be in the short term, but he's so young. I can't rule out the possibility that he could follow like a Sonny Gray trajectory with the strikeout rate. And after a few years of being a 7.5, maybe 8 Ks per 9 sort of guy, maybe something clicks and that number jumps up a little bit.
Yeah, I'm on agreement. I know a lot of people don't. I like to bake in some growth on players I believe are good. You know, if I don't think you're a good player, I don't see it. But from what, just watching this, if you watch this kid and how he attacks the game cerebrally as well, I think there's a lot to like here.
The next guy I want to talk about is Josh James. The Astros didn't do much to really reinforce their rotation with external options after losing Garrett Cole to the Yankees in free agency. James has jumped up 50 picks. He was at 320 in January. He's at 270 in February. I think that's just the function of no one else being added to that competition. And, you know, James is getting a chance to stretch out. Not a surprise this spring, given their needs. Big fastball, good slider, good changeup. It's really the command that is the major issue. And we saw that kind of reflected in the overall numbers last year. The ERA was close to 5. The whip was at 132. But he had 100 in strikeouts in 61 and a third innings. And he had a really nice run very late in 2018 with the Astros as well. Are you on board with Josh James as a riser? Because I think the price is going to keep going up. If you like him, you better buy him now because the price is going to creep up above 250, maybe even up to the low like 200 to 225 range once we get to the end of March.
Yeah, no, I do like him. I played the Josh James game last season and lost out on that one. But, you know, they have a couple of names here. I mean, even when you look at McCullers, who's going in the late hundreds, like 185 or somewhere in that range, then you have Jose Urquidy. There's some very interesting names. For me, the problem with James is, can he do it, you know, three times through the order? We all really see the talent here. But, you know, having to do it as a starter as opposed to a reliever will be interesting. And it's going to come down to something I've harped on all preseason, rotation construction. I do like the pitcher, but, you know, at this point in the game, when we get to this range, I'm looking at a bunch of different things and how my rotation is best complemented at that point.
Right. So you might be thinking about what you did earlier. If you have a Greinke or a Hendricks or a Soroka and you don't have elite closers who are plus-plus in terms of strikeout rates, you're not getting above-average contributions from relievers, that's where someone like James might make a lot of sense because you went the route of maybe fortifying your ratios over a large number of innings and you want to make up some ground in the K's category. I think that's kind of an ideal sort of usage. So I could see that being kind of a driving factor in, you know, where you choose to draft Josh James. But overall, he's definitely a guy that I would like to have on teams this year.
I got a question for you, actually, because I'm looking, like I said, I like to look the last week too. We have the numbers that I think are good that you put together. But it might even come down to, say, a Josh James versus a Mitch Keller. And who do you prefer more? You know, James has the better team. I mean, the Pirates' offense is, you know, being depleted, you know, day by day. But they do have a new philosophy in pitching, which I'm very excited about since they've moved on from Ray Sears. So that's going to be an interesting thing, I think, as we go live. Is it Mitch Keller or Josh James? Mitch Keller I had on several teams. I bought him early for nothing and was hoping he could be a thing, but he needed those growing pains. And I think this year we could see the growing pains pay some dividends.
I think I'm on Keller as the safer of the two, even though the results were disastrous last year. I mean, a 7.13 ERA and a 1.83 whip. But I think he's got just a little bit more balance in his arsenal. So even though he's not as overpowering with his fastball, he's got above average fastball, curveball, slider, and he's got at least above average command. And I just think the command can really stabilize things in a way where Josh James is going to be the kind of guy that you may drive yourself mad having him on your roster, because he's going to have starts where he comes out and strikes out 9 guys in 5 innings, gets a win, only allows a couple hits, and, you know, is great. And then he's going to have days when he doesn't even get out of the third because he can't find the strike zone. Like, that's going to happen. And I think with Keller and that organizational philosophy, I'm glad you brought that up, there's a better chance that he's going 6 innings, positioning himself to be more of an asset in ratios. So I think they do slightly different things. Like, if you said who's going to strike more guys out in an equal number of innings, I would take James every single time. I just think he's out there trying to get a ton of whiffs. But I think Keller is just a little bit safer for me. So if the Pirates didn't have a new organizational philosophy with their pitching, it would be James hands down. But that's part of what's making this possible for me, is that they seem to have a new approach that's going to work well for guys like Keller and for Joe Musgrove as well. I know I've heard the sleeper in the bus guys talk about him a lot, and big part of it was with the velocity bump at the end of last year. But Keller was unlucky in a lot of ways. Like, he struggled, he made mistakes, but you don't usually see a 3.19 FIP underneath a 7.13 ERA over a 48 inning sample.
Yeah, with Keller, one of the key things is he's a player that you have to look under the hood, look at the strikeouts versus walks, and, you know, it's a maturation. It's a tough thing that first time. And that's what I do like is he had that experience. He had that initial experience. He got beat up and all that, but there were some good things to see there. And with Musgrove, that curveball as well that he implemented. But I did see this morning that he admits to complaining about shoulder soreness, so that could be a bummer.
Yeah, that would be very disappointing. Let's move on to Nick Anderson. Talk about a reliever who's jumped up. There's basically one huge reliever mover, Nick Anderson going up, and then Emilio Pagan going down. It's the result of the same sort of thing. I mean, Pagan getting traded to San Diego opened up saves in Tampa Bay. Nick Anderson at 155, so 60 picks earlier than he was going. I wasn't even really on him at 218 because of the crowd in the Tampa Bay bullpen. And even though Pagan's gone, Matt, I still see other guys. I see Diego Castillo. I see Jose Alvarado. Andrew Kittredge could get in the mix. Like, they have plenty of ways to finish out games. And as good as Nick Anderson was last year, I just don't think I'm going near him at that inflated price.
Well, here's the thing. I'll make the case for Nick Anderson. We have some good radio here. I'll play the devil's advocate. I'm looking at the closers in this range, and he is moving up even further in the last week. I think he's like 135 now. But there's Rocio Iglesias. There's Colome, Workman. You know, I think Colome could lose a job. I don't think the skills are that great. I'm just going to be honest with you. And I don't think the White Sox are in a position to wait. Brendan Workman, as good as he was, I know he gave up like one barrel all last year and, you know, all that. But he's walking. His walk rate is just insane. And I don't see how you survive with that, you know, as a closer. And I could see a move made there as well. for me, the argument I'll make for Nick Anderson is he doesn't have to save 35 saves at this point in the draft. If he gets a third of their saves and strikes out, say, circa 100 batters or more, he's pretty much a Josh Hader light going five rounds later or whatever, seven rounds later, whatever it is, five, six rounds later. So for me, if you have that first closer already and you add an Anderson, I think he's going to play a pivotal role in this bullpen for the Rays. I don't believe he'll get every save, but I think he doesn't need to get every save, especially as your second closer. The market has changed with how many saves you need. And even acquiring saves in season last year was a lot cheaper. I mean, most of the bids were double digit. There weren't triple digit bids, because nobody was certain on if these guys could hold roles. So we're going to see a lot of flipping and some other guys getting opportunities maybe we didn't think would get them.
I think the ratios and strikeout rate potential, I mean, are good enough to make him rosterable in mixed leagues, even if he's not getting the bulk of the saves, as you suggested. So I don't disagree with that. I think what I'm stuck on here, aside from the alternatives they could use to close out the games, that swinging strike rate jumped to 19.3%. That's amazing. That's a great swinging strike rate. It supports a crazy high strikeout rate. But we never even saw a swinging strike rate, you know, near that high in the minors. We saw 13.9% at AA, 14.9% at AAA. That was in 2017 and 2018 in the Twins organization. And that was still amazing. That was still really good results. High K rates, 29.6% and 36.2% at AA and AAA, respectively. So I'm just wondering if everything kind of peaked skills-wise for him last year, and there's going to be some pullback. But even if he strikes out 35% of the batters he's facing this year, that's really good in the range. So I'm with you on the better by comparison thing. I think what I'm doing to counteract this with the uncertainty about saves and being very NFBC-centric with this thinking, at least, I'm trying to get to a second closer before Anderson, not really because of the skills, but because of the uncertainty with the role and thinking about the overall. Like, maybe it does take fewer saves to win. I'm just worried about that outcome you described, where he is Hader light and he ends up getting a dozen saves, and you know, someone else like Alvarado or Castillo or Kittredge or literally anyone else picks up 8, 10, 12 of their own, and you do that a couple of times. That's kind of what they did last year. I mean, everybody was getting saves in the Tampa Bay bullpen a season ago. So good point, though, because I'm not on Workman. I'm not on Kennedy. I'm absolutely not on Alex Colomé. I think Aaron Bummer is probably one of my favorite non-closer relievers. And I think the thing that separates Bummer from Anderson, I mean, Anderson has just a way higher strikeout ceiling at this point. But we saw the White Sox make that commitment to Bummer. And I think we're still looking at a case with Bummer where things can get better. I think the K rate can actually get up in the high 20% range. Has that really heavy sink as well. Really does a good job of limiting homers. They have other lefties they can throw out there as well. So I think what it comes down to for me is I'm still generally not comfortable throwing a 150 range pick at a guy, a high leverage reliever who has elite skills, if we don't know for sure they have the job, in part because I'd rather throw late darts on guys who I think can get saves or even find the next Nick Anderson. You can usually find those guys on the waiver wire, and you still might get saves even going the waiver wire route. It seems like he's a rare commodity who could pay off in a huge way, but I think there's some downside that's sort of like out of his control.
Yeah, no, there definitely is, and it's just, I hate drafting closers. I mean, we have to do it, and I try, like, I really want to take Hader, but he keeps moving up, as was to be expected, as we got closer and closer. And outside of, like, Hader, say, Yates and stuff, and, you know, a couple other guys, there's not a lot of guys that I have that confidence in, and I hate blowing a pick on a guy that, if I think there's a realistic chance of him losing a job.
Let's talk about a few hitters that have been on the rise. One very early, Starling Marte, I think from January to February, moved up about six spots. And people might say six spots in ADP doesn't mean much. It means a lot more when you're already inside the top 40. Like that's actually a pretty big jump. Mm-hmm. It's a half round jump. How much more valuable do you think he is in Arizona just being in a better lineup? I mean, do you think the ADP now reflects that, or do you think he's still a little bit underpriced even with that bump?
I think he's priced correctly, honestly. I do like him going to Arizona. It's not the ballpark that it was for home runs and all that crazy offense with the humidor in there. But having a better supporting cast should, you know, turn that lineup over more. And in an environment where speed has become so precious, I still think he's going to steal those bases. I'm more concerned, can he hit the 20 home runs? I don't really think he's a 20 home run guy. And I tweeted that yesterday. I think there's going to be corrections with players. I think the ball will see somewhat of a change. I don't think you're going to have what you had last season. But I still think this guy can hit, you know, in the high teens in home runs. So with the runs you're getting, the stolen bases, and that batting average, these are things you want. These are things you need early on. And, you know, when you can get a batting average with the stolen bases, plus runs and home runs that are not going to be single digits, I think that's a winning player.
Yeah, I mean, I just think the stolen base floor is pretty good there. He's going to score runs. Batting average is steady. I'm with you. And there's power to go with it. It's not a ton of power, but it's enough power where you don't have to chase as much if you draft Marte as you will if you take guys that are a little more one-dimensional, I guess we'll call them. Some other guys in that range, we don't have to go in great detail on most of them, who've just crept up a little bit over the course of January to February. Edelberto Mondesi jumped up about four spots. I think that's to be expected. He was at like ADP of 34. He's at 30 now. I think he's going to keep ticking up a little bit here. The further we get into spring, as health continues to be something that he proves he has when the season approaches, I think people are going to get more and more aggressive with him, because just from a rotisserie standpoint, he can do a lot of the things we've been hoping Trey Turner would do over a full season. The key with Mondesi, though, coming off a shoulder injury, maybe that power's not there right away. I mean, where do you fall on Edelberto Mondesi in general? At the 2-3 turn of a 15-teamer right now, or in the middle of the third round of a 12-teamer, are you comfortable paying that price given the wide range of outcomes that he brings to the table?
Honestly, I'm not comfortable paying the price, and it's a player that I would love to draft. But that's that, as you said, the health concern here with the shoulder injury, and you know, playing shortstop, running, a lot could go wrong. You know, if you know, he spent time, you know, last year, he's coming off a serious injury, but I get it. His ability, that 60 is not like out of the question. 60 could be realistic if he gets the games played. So I understand why his price is there, and it's a guy like I want to take, but I'm hesitant to do so.
That description could also be applied to Max Muncy for totally different reasons. I've noticed that he's crept up the board about 10 spots from January to February, within the top 100, so from 88 to 78. I love that you can play him at first, at second, and third. I think position flexibility is really nice, and we've talked about it on a few of our shows, and mostly it just helps you out because you have an injury in season or you make a midweek lineup change in the NFBC. Being able to shuffle things around, you can go corner to middle with guys that are first and second. Third's a nice little bonus, even though there's plenty of depth there. That just makes your life easier. It allows you to max out on favorable matchups and to max out on playing time. Do you think the price on Muncy, 78 overall, is too high or just right?
For me, it's a little too high. Maybe I just never came full on board with the Max Muncy. I get the power. The power's real. So if the ball is corrected, this is a guy that I will say can still hit it out of the park. He's not going to – I don't think he's going to be one of the guys that suffer if there is a correction that is coming. But when I look in the range of players there, like – Ramon Laureano's going next to him. Nelson Cruz is going right next to him. Even Anthony Rizzo. All other guys I'd rather have over Muncy. I get the flexibility, but it's not enough for me to say I'm going to take Muncy over any of those, you know, three guys I just mentioned.
I got roasted really good about a year ago by Mike Gianella from Baseball Prospectus. I was talking about the Dodgers depth chart. I think it was on the RotoWire pod because it was before I made the move here to The Athletic. And I was talking through their depth chart, and he sent the gif of Charlie Day from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia from the Pepe Silva episode, for anyone who's familiar with the show. Right. He's got the mail, and he's got it all up on the wall, and he's got the strings, you know, trying to connect everything, trying to figure out a conspiracy. So he sent that over after I spent like 10 minutes just talking in circles about the Dodgers a year ago. And I'm Charlie in the mailroom again. I can't get past this depth chart yet again this season, because I keep looking at this team and I keep saying, okay, Jock Peterson's still there, he could be gone. They could trade him in the next few weeks. That could still happen. But he's there for now. And this is a guy that led off against righties a lot last year. Maybe he moves down in the order because Mookie's there. But they played him a lot last year. And I can't imagine they're going to just play him a lot less. They have a natural platoon with Peterson and Pollock. Pollock makes too much money. And I think Pollock's actually a better player than people are giving him credit for, but he's had a ton of bad injuries. So the thing I keep getting really hung up on is that I think there's a chance that Cody Bellinger, even though he's a great outfielder, is going to move to first base more often than we think. Max Muncy's going to slide over and play second, or Max Muncy's going to have to sit on the bench because they want to play Gavin Lux. So both Muncy and Lux are guys that I really like, and unless something like Justin Turner getting hurt happens, which can happen, like I just have a hard time seeing those two guys coexisting, and I just think there's a chance that Jock and Pollock actually become bigger parts of the lineup in the outfield than Muncy ends up being around the infield. Because versatility absolutely helps, but I'm really stuck on Muncy and Lux and how exactly the Dodgers are going to make that work. I mean, I've suggested this before. Like, do you see any downside with Lux that includes just being optioned down because they want him to play every day and they can't play him every day to begin the season if everybody's still here and healthy?
I personally don't see it. I think they're going to – I think they want to start the season with him as their second baseman and lock that in, and hopefully maybe he could move up in that lineup. Like, for me, if I was writing that lineup, Corey Seager would be batting second. I mean, that's just me. Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't see how Seager – I know he had the injury, you know, that he missed basically the whole season – he came back last year, played 134 games. But this guy can hit. He can flat out hit. I think he's going to be a nice bounce back guy. And like you said, I think the best bet here is Justin Turner's health. I mean, I like Turner at his ADP. He can still swing the stick. But, you know, another year older, and he's had the injuries in the past. So it could work out. I think a trade of Peterson is the most beneficial way, or an injury to Turner.
And since they already did it once, they tried to do it and it got hung up, and then Artie Moreno backed out. I want to operate under the assumption that Jock Peterson won't be on this team on opening day. I just think that's probably a little bit dangerous because teams now know they want to move him and they have lost leverage. So long story short, I like Muncy as a player. I like the versatility. The price isn't even that bad for the skills. I'm worried about the playing time at the price, so I'm probably going somewhere else. I like Rizzo. I like Laureano, some of the guys you mentioned. I like the pitchers that go around there, too. Jose Barrios is there. Brandon Woodruff is there. You mentioned Cruz before. Josh Donaldson is in that range. Mm-hmm. Matt Chapman's in that range. Like, I'm not worried about how much those guys are going to play, and that's a huge, huge driving factor for me in making that call. Nick Castellanos jumped up. He signed with the Reds in January, so obviously February, people knew where he was going to play. They're excited about the lineup, excited about the park. I don't think that's a big surprise. I mean, this is a guy who's had an ADP in this range before. Do you think going to Cincinnati, going to the most homer-friendly park he's ever played in the big leagues, is Nick Castellanos actually underpriced if his ADP stays around that 97 mark?
I think it could be. You look at the batting average year after year, and you know he played most of his career in a park where home runs go to die, and we got a glimpse in limited action at Wrigley with the Cubs and all that. You know, being in a different environment, I do like the Reds revamping this lineup. Suarez's shoulder getting healthy is key to that as well. So I think he's going to be in a prime position to deliver, and you're getting that batting average as well. Okay, maybe you're not getting any speed, but you're pretty much getting, I think, everything else. This is a guy that has been atop the extra base leaderboard for years now. I mean, he's just a extra base hit machine. So I think this park will be very positive for him.
Yeah, I don't have anything really to add to that, so we'll just move on. A couple other risers in that range, Tim Anderson, Zach Greinke, have crept up in the bottom part of the top 100. So interesting to see those guys ticking up slightly. We're just talking a handful of picks, but interesting nonetheless. Let's shift the focus over to fallers. And kind of like I said with Starling Marte, you know, a move of five or six spots when you're up in the top 40 is actually pretty significant. The biggest faller in that range among healthy players is Alex Bregman. He was a first rounder at 12. Now he's a mid-second rounder at 17. Clearly, you know, people are looking at the Astros and they're skeptical of these players, you know, reaching their peak levels with the sign-stealing scandal exposed. Where do you fall on Bregman in particular? And do you have any sort of blanket approach with the Astros as a whole, with early round Astros? Like, do you have any sort of thing you've been doing to account for, you know, the extra help this team was generating for itself over what may have been the better part of the last three seasons?
I really don't want early Astros. For me, Bregman was a guy that I would have bet the under on him hitting 40 homers again. That said, he's a really good hitter. I mean, the average will be there. He's still going to be a good player. If he fell even further, then yeah, then I'm probably interested in him. But I have expectations. You know, what are your expectations? I know I hear people say, well, he hit 40 homers last year. I don't think he's hitting 40 homers this year. But he still can be very good and deserve a price in this range. But you are seeing it. The Astros have been hit, what, like seven times already? Or that was a couple of days ago I saw that. So, you know, there are going to be teams sending a message, and that's never a good thing. And they're just going to be, and it's going to be a tough situation. I think mentally it's going to be the most trying thing. And maybe a guy like Bregman thrives off that, uses it as a motivational thing, and really succeeds. But, you know, Bregman, Altuve's fallen too a bit, but I don't think Altuve's going to run. So that's why I'm kind of like off him as well. So we'll see.
I almost wonder, yeah, if Bregman just likes being the villain and will find a way to like pull positive energy for himself out of an otherwise like very taxing situation. I think it's going to be a grind for this team all season long. I think they're great players who did a terrible thing to get an edge. And at the end of the day, when you try and figure out how much to ding him, it's really difficult to do that. I think you're right to be skeptical of Bregman's power anyway. Like, if this story, if we didn't know this had ever happened, like, I think his home run total would have jumped off the page from the rabbit ball year as one that you say, okay, Alex Bregman's a better player than we thought when they drafted him out of LSU. No one ever thought 41 homers was coming. Like, that seems like way like at the upper bounds of the most optimistic projections. So I think if you take him back down to the low to mid 30s in the home run category, that's pretty reasonable. I don't think he should fall a lot further than he's fallen right now. But I'm trying to avoid unnecessary risk when it comes to already injured players. And this is a situation where, you know, the injury is more psychological. You know, we don't have a timeline for how long it's going to take for them to just adjust to how much everybody hates them now.
Yeah, just think about this. Like you say psychological. Think about when players are going through a divorce that season, or they have a baby, and, you know, I don't have kids, but I got to think the first kid you have is, like, really stressful, and there's a lot going on there. So just, you know, these are normal, everyday people as well. So when you start putting that in, it starts taking toll. So, I mean, look, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he, you know, this year he's the MVP and just goes bananas. But I agree. If I can, you know, there's other players I like here that don't have these issues that I'm willing to take.
Yeah, just why take on the extra risk if you have an option right there, several options right there who do a lot of other things that are just as good, if not better in some cases. Biggest pitching faller at the top of the board has been an injured guy, of course, Mike Clevinger falling from 20 to 31, and that's not including Luis Severino, who is out for the season and has fallen off the board completely. But with a knee injury, the expectation for Clevinger has been that he'll miss probably about three starts when the season gets here. Is pick 31 cheap enough? Like, given the nature of the injury and that timeline, like, do you believe he's going to be back and he's going to be himself quickly enough for you to justify spending a third round pick on him in a 12-team league?
I mean, for me, I'm kind of pissed because I was all in on Clevinger. I had him as SP4 before the injury. I was taking him ahead of Verlander and Scherzer. And it wasn't just to, you know, That's what I believe. And I put my money where my mouth is and all that. But the thing that does scare me a bit, even though he misses, say, three starts, is how this injury affects his delivery and stuff. That I don't know. Does he come back, you know, a little too soon? Because, I mean, Rob Silver had a great tweet. He, even in 126 innings pitched last year, I think he was SP 18, maybe even 16, but I think it was 18. So maybe if I have the turn, and like say I have I drafted Ronald Acuna or Mike Trout or Yelich, whatever of the big three you prefer, and I'm at that 2-3 turn in a 15-team league, and I'm going to go Clevinger, and I'm going to take another pitcher there, then I could possibly do it. Because, I mean, I love this kid, but the thing that, you know, a knee injury is not ideal for a starting pitcher. That's where you plant, you push off. This is very valuable. It's, you know, not just the elbow and the shoulder we got to worry about. So I'm in a tough situation here. I haven't figured out my final strategy on Clevinger, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, and when it comes to repeating mechanics, you know, just having healthy legs is one really important aspect. It's the base. A similar question. We don't talk a lot about news on this show. We kind of split up our shows a little differently mm-hmm. this year. So there's Fantasy Baseball in 15, by the way, if you want a nice quick morning show every weekday morning. Al Melkier's on there every day. I'm on there a few days a week, and Michael Beller's on there a few days a week as well as co-host. So be sure to check that out if you want to get your news first thing each weekday morning. Blake Snell is kind of in the same boat as Clevinger, I think. If we're looking like February to March, I think we're going to see a slight dip because he just had an injection in his arm. Fortunately, it was a cortisone shot, and it was supposed to be like the outside part of the elbow. So apparently that's less severe, less of a concern, relatively speaking. I just saw a report today. Mark Topkin from the Tampa Bay Times had something about Snell feeling good. He's still on track to play catch on Tuesday. So that's been the timeline going back to the end of last week. Where do you go with Snell? Like, if you were drafting this week and you're just limited to seeing him maybe play catch on Tuesday, can you buy blind in the early rounds on Blake Snell?
Unfortunately, I cannot, and I really like Snell. The first 2 months last year, like I stated in the past, you know, like a 36 strikeout percentage. This is an incredibly talented pitcher when healthy. And I didn't mind, you know, coming into this year before hearing the cortisone shot and stuff. He had loose bodies removed from his elbow last year in season. And I go back to what Ron Darling said a couple of years ago on MLB Network back in the, like, say, November, when he talked about Jacob DeGrom, whose ADP that year shot up from, like, the fifth round to the second round when he started throwing 97 in spring training. And Darling said, I had that procedure. I had it later than DeGrom. I was fine for spring training. So that's why I was in on DeGrom that year. But he had that, and now if he's feeling any sort of pain and stuff, it just doesn't sound good to me. And I might have had him like seventh or eighth in my initial starting pitcher rankings. Right now, I'm nervous, and I got to step away right now.
Yeah, I'm just kind of in that holding pattern where someone else might get a bit of a deal and it could pay mm-hmm. off. But I think the main reason why I'm just piecing out, as Paul Sporer might say, on Blake Snell is that I don't want to expose myself to the early injury risk. But I look at this and say, this is a guy that had this problem last year. That's the mm-hmm. big difference. Like, if this were just a cortisone shot for the first time for someone who didn't have an elbow injury a year ago, I might say around two rounds is enough of a discount to go ahead and take on the risk, but I'm not quite there. We'll see how much he falls. I mean, if he falls four or five rounds or something, then maybe we can talk about it. I just don't expect him to fall that far. So
yeah, he won't.
It's kind of a moot point for now. We do have some interesting droppage when it comes to James Paxton. From 91 in January to 181, his timetable seems like it's been more encouraging in recent weeks mm-hmm. as far as his back injury goes. He might begin throwing this week, potentially. That was a report I saw, I think, from Brandon Cudi from the New York Star-Ledger. So I'm just looking at this situation with Paxton, and he came up. I was talking to Derek Carty and Eno Saris during the labor auctions this weekend, and Derek's opinion was that Paxton is being overcorrected on right now. Like, the projections, the amount of innings he's supposed to throw, it's all still good enough to where if you're getting him at pick 181, where he was going in February, you're getting a steal. And a two-part question on Paxton. One, do you agree with Derek's assessment? And two, if you're willing to roster a player like that, is he really the only player who's not giving you something right away you're going to hold in an NFBC format where you only have those seven bench spots? Like, how comfortable are you using up a roster spot on an injured player or a player beginning the year in the minors, knowing that you have a little less flexibility until that player comes back?
First question, I agree. I think, you know, it's fallen to a spot. Look, I'll give you a broke back moment here. I can't quit James Paxton. And we saw he injured the knee. He had a rough little going. Then he reeled off 10 phenomenal starts like in a row. He's on the Yankees. At this price, I'm looking. He's going side by side in the last week with Carlos Martinez. I'm going to take Paxton every time. I'll wait the 2 months. It's encouraging, the news. The other guy going right after him is Mike Minor. I'm telling you right now, I don't want any Mike Minor this year. He was awesome last year. There were warning signs early in the year. Fantastic story Mike Minor is, but he's not going to be on my teams this year. I think people are misreading Mike Minor. I'll say that. The other question, how many guys can you hold? If you take a Paxton here, you can maybe take one, say, high-end prospect that you think is going to be up within that first month, and that's it. You can't be taking other injured players. That's got to be your thing, because you'll learn if you have it. If you did it last year, you probably learned. But if you do it this year, you'll learn that lesson awful quick. It's just, in this type of a format where there's an overall and counting stats are imperative. You have to keep adding and you have to keep getting them. You just can't do it. So,
yeah, it's the worst type of league to have injury optimism in general. So, yeah, two is the number for you early in the season. And I assume if you lose a key player, you're dropping that prospect who's not giving you anything probably as your first cut or your injured guy, depending on who exactly it is. But I think in the case of Paxton, he's on the short list of injured guys. It's the back injury. He's making good progress. It's enough of a discount. The skills are actually very stable. He gets a little underrated anyway because of the issues he's had in the past with injuries. I'm there. I'm right there with you. And I think the key is discipline. Being willing to cut that late prospect. If you draft Dylan Carlson in the 20th round and you also drafted James Paxton and you need to make a drop a couple weeks into the season, Carlson might be that drop. Like, you just have to have that ability to cut ties, even though you like the player. Like, that's just how it goes.
And that's really tough. I think that's an excellent point, because when you take that prospect that you're banking on for that first month or first couple of weeks to come up, cutting him is one of the most difficult things you're going to experience, because you know, if he gets the call a week or two later, somebody else most likely is going to benefit from that guy. Because you obviously drafted him. You were willing to take that pick. You know, all picks matter. I know we're taking lottery picks later on, but there's a reason why you actually drafted him. And then he goes in the pool, and he's pretty much anybody else can have him.
Yeah, frustrating indeed just to think about him going off on someone else's roster. I've been paralyzed by that fear many times looking
at the perfect word.
Kyle Tucker.
The perfect word.
You just sit there.
Paralyzed.
You're frozen. Like, you sit there and you can't get away from that player. You're like, oh, I can't cut Kyle Tucker because he's gonna go 2020 or prorated 2020 the rest of the season when he comes up, and you know, months pass and I still have Kyle Tucker and now I'm under where I need to be on runs and RBIs and my batting average maybe isn't as locked in as it should be because of the misplaying time too. It's really frustrating. But speaking of pools, Eugenio Suarez was injured in a pool this offseason. How's that for a transition? He dropped about 20 picks from January to February. Pick 90 is where his ADP was at the end of the month. He started swinging a bat with both arms off of a tee at the end of last week. That was for the first time since late January. So about a one-month break for him. Loose cartilage was removed from his right shoulder. This is one where I like Suarez. I like the lineup. I like the park. I don't like passing on completely healthy players instead, like his teammate Nick Castellanos or Eddie Rosario or Marcus Semien or Joey Gallo if I've got plenty of average and want a big power boost, or Jeff McNeil or Matt Chapman might still be there around that same range. There's just no reason in my head at that price to say, I'm going to take the guy who had shoulder surgery this winter instead of the guy who's completely healthy going through spring training.
Yeah, I got to agree with you here. And look, I didn't think he was hitting 50 homers again, but I did think he was a power source guy. You know, that park plays for him. I did see him in an interview. I watched the spring training game last week. They were having a – it was actually really funny. He seems like a hell of a guy. The Cincinnati Reds guy that does the sign announcing, whatever you want to call it, in the ballpark, Jim Day, they were kind of joking with him. And he says he's feeling great and all that, but, you know, I never really want to believe a player. I'm not going to take what the player is saying. And I'm probably going to, like you, I'm going to go elsewhere to a guy that, you know, like an Eddie Rosario who year in and year out outperforms his ADP and is completely healthy. Where Matt Chapman, who, you know, is an MVP defender and could be an MVP bat if that average ever got up. So, yeah, I'm on board with you there.
I mean, I see, like, from a profile standpoint with Eugenio Suarez, like, the K rate was up at 28.5% last year. Like, I don't think people have really talked about that a ton, in part because we're talking about the injury instead. It came with that 14% barrel rate, easily a career high, very, very high barrel rate. Mm-hmm. But the exit velocity for the season was down at 89.4. So he actually dropped in exit velocity last year a little bit. 89.4 is not bad, but there's just some numbers on that StatCast page to give you pause. A 248 batting average, or XBA rather, that's just not where I want to be either. So you put an injury on top of that and lots of other interesting players. Easy pass for me at that discounted price. Shohei Ohtani's dropped about a dozen picks, 120 to 133. More pitching limitations early. Matt, he's just a really tough player to roster in weekly leagues, especially these leagues that we're talking about where you've got seven bench spots, because he might be a high-priced guy who spends a surprising amount of time on your bench and reduces flexibility. At this point, I would almost be happier if they just said, he's not going to pitch at all in 2020. He's going to hit, and he's going to hit 6 days a week. Because if he were going to hit 6 days a week, he'd go 80 picks earlier.
Yeah, I'm with you. It is concerning, but I do like this player. And the cheaper he gets, the more interested. Obviously, if you're in a daily league, it's a totally different animal. The weekly league, it is very tough where you have to make that commitment. But he's going to be a hitter, and he's a good enough hitter where, you know, he can get those numbers for you those first couple of months. I like him more in a draft champions format. I think he's really a good player. In the auction I did last night, which was an auction but with a draft champions component, the next 27 rounds is a draft champions. I took him for $9, and I took him because I know what he can do with the bat. If he has any setback pitching, maybe they just say, screw it, he's not going to pitch. And if everything goes well with his pitching, and in a couple of months, he's in that rotation, and I'm going to need arms throughout the year. So the flexibility there, I think, really helps. But if we go live in 2 weeks, what am I doing with Ohtani? I don't have that answer just yet.
It's got to be a daily league or a draft and hold league or a really deep AL-only league for me right now.
I'm kind of with you. But
I believe in the skills. I think he's an amazing and fun player, but he is a nightmare in weekly formats with limited bench spaces. Mitch Haniger, a big faller. I mean, I don't think there's much for us to say here. He's not going to be able to lift weights for at least a month following his surgery. That was back on February 13th. We're only at March 2nd, so that's at least a month. So we're still a couple of weeks away from him to begin workouts. I think he's on the IL for at least April and probably more. I mean, he's got a back injury, core injury. Had a really gnarly injury, of course, with a foul ball last year. I mean, just it's bad. It's unfortunate because I think Mitch Haniger is a good player, and there's really no question about how much he would play on this Mariners team if he were healthy. But I don't think I'm drafting him in leagues that don't have IL spots. And if I were an AL labor, I played an NL, maybe I would have gone $3-5 on him at most just to have some flexibility. I could have reserved him or I could have IL'd him, played somebody on my reserve list for a while. I don't think you want to have injury optimism with Mitch Haniger in shallow mixed leagues in particular going into this season.
Yeah, he's just kind of in a void for me right now. I don't know when he's going to be back on the field. You know, it just seems like it's just gotten worse and worse with his health and stuff. So I'd rather have, say, a Jonas Cespedes than a Machaniger. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, they're kind of in the same bucket, and Cespedes is healthier right now. So that's the yikes. That's where it's at, I guess, at this point. We talked about Nick Castellanos earlier as a riser. There's been a corresponding drop. Aristides Aquino has fallen from 170 to 236. I'm still struggling to get a good read on how the Cincinnati outfield's actually going to work, but Aquino having options left, I think there's a chance he has to go down. And even if he stays up, he's not going to play enough for shallow mixed leagues, at least initially, if everybody's healthy.
Yeah, I mean, the way it's set up right now, I think if Nick Senzel is healthy, they want him in that lineup. They want him to, say, a Senzel, a Castellanos, and an Akiyama, you know, for the most part, with maybe Jesse Winker. They got another guy, Jesse Winker, a really good bat. Mm-hmm. I think Aquino has to go down. He has the options. I heard they were going to try him in center field. I think the first shot at wasn't real successful, but we'll see. And he still has an opportunity to improve that. You know, September swoon was kind of really ugly. So with him having the options, I'm just going to have to assume, because you got Irvin on that roster too. I mean, barring a trade, what are they going to do with all these players, you know, out there in the outfield? And you don't want a kid, you don't want a guy like Aquino just sitting the bench. I don't think that's going to be helpful for him.
No, it's like the Gavin Lux problem in a different way. I mean, I know Lux is a much more highly regarded prospect, but you want your young players to get a lot of playing time. Deeper benches maybe will tempt teams to hold players. And the difference in pedigree might be the kind of thing where they say, you know what, he broke AAA last year. We really don't need him to do that, so we'll have him here. We'll have more dangerous depth. We'll have guys that can come off the bench and pinch hit. We'll do double switches. Maybe they'll be creative that way if they want to keep him around. But in that scenario, I'm still worried about his playing time, and I'm staying away unless someone is out for a prolonged stretch in the rotation. I mean, you got Akiyama, Winker, Senzel, Castellanos, and Aquino. That just doesn't work. Like, there are just five guys there. And even with the Suarez injury, if Moustakas were playing third base and they were going to play Nick Senzel in the infield, that's still four guys in the outfield battling for spots. If they were to keep Philip Irvin around as a platoon guy, that could complicate things as well. So I've got Aquino in the RotoWire Dynasty Invitational. I'm not going to have him anywhere else if things hold up in their current form. I mentioned AJ Pollock in passing a little bit earlier. He's dropped from 241 to 267. Not really noteworthy, I think, in any way. Just me just kind of saying, I don't understand why his price has fallen, because in January his situation looked just like it did in February. And if anything, I was kind of surprised that there wasn't a little bump in ADP in February from the drafts that occurred when we thought Jock Peterson was going to go to the Angels. Because if that were to happen, I think AJ Pollock's role against righties especially would be significantly increased. But that's a guy that was an early round pick not that long ago, and it's just been one injury after another that's really slowed him down with the Dodgers. So old and boring, Matt, but the kind of guy that I kind of want to throw the dart on late.
Look, Pollock's been a guy I've always chased, and I've kind of come to the realization I don't know if he can ever stay healthy. The price is right, but it's just, what do you need at this point? Do you want power? I'm going to go for a Randall Grichuk kind of guy. Or even a guy like Domingo Santana, who just a year ago everybody was really high on. He's got some power, speed. Injuries kind of sunk his season last year. He should have a really good opportunity in his new home. So there's just other guys there, or other positions to fill. Or maybe you believe in Gregory Polanco. He's another guy coming back. So it's just, I get it. I think maybe he does see a bit of a bump when we go live, because I know there are a lot of people that do like him.
Yeah, and by the time we get to the late part of March, we may have a better indication of what the Dodgers are going to do to balance out the playing time, or we may have an injury between now and then as well. So I'm intrigued at the price. I'm willing to throw the dart and see how it plays out. He's in the range price-wise where he's late enough where if I don't like how much he's playing, then he becomes droppable, and that's okay. That's a gamble I'm willing to take. That is going to wrap things up for this episode of the Athletic Fantasy Baseball Podcast. If you're not already a subscriber, you can get 40% off a subscription to The Athletic at theathletic.com/fantasybaseballpodcast. Lots of great articles and New cheat sheets, I think, are launching here today on Monday, so be sure to check those out. Pretty much everything you could want to get ready for the 2020 season. You can follow Matt on Twitter at CTM Baseball. You can follow me at Derek Van Riper. For Matt Medica, I'm Derek Van Riper. We're back on Wednesday with Under the Radar. Thank you.